The essential and regular act we do every day, all of us, is go to the toilet. And in this country, most of us have the luxury of committing that act in a safe, clean and well-plumbed environment. But not that long ago, things were very different. In the Australia of the 1850s, for example, public defecation was rife. Washing your hands after using the bathroom was completely unfashionable, and having a toilet at home was simply unheard of. And it may have stayed that way if not for a world-changing event known as the Great British Stink. Never heard of it? Well, luckily, to mark World Toilet Day, which is tomorrow, my first guest in the conversation today is professorial fellow at Melbourne University's Department of Infrastructure and Engineering, and he also happens to be a toilet innovator, John Longford. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. Well, you want me to speak on the Great Stink?
I do, but before we get to that stink, I want to ask you about how it is that I can call you a toilet innovator.
Well, in the early 1980s, Melbourne was suffering a drought, and Melburnians were using a very large amount of water, and there was a new innovation about called the dual-flush toilet. So I was instrumental in, with the help of David White, the then Water Minister, in getting the regulations made. So from the 1st of July 1984, every toilet in Victoria, new and replacement, had to be dual flush.
And how long before that dual flush innovation spread its way across the country?
Well, reasonably quickly, similar regulations were passed in the other states because the manufacturers have to sell across other states and it created a market. But at that time, only about 2% of the toilets were dual flush. Now it's 80% plus, and it saved about 45,000 megalitres. That's about 10% of Melbourne's water use.
And so how much water now are we using with dual flush toilets compared to before you introduced?
It was 11 litres before, and now it's an average of 4.
And so in doing that, that's almost, two-thirds less, almost two-thirds.
Yes, exactly.
What are our water usage amounts now compared to those days prior to dual flush?
Well, Melburnians would be surprised, but the amount of, total amount of water Melbourne is using now is exactly the same as it was, or less, 30 years ago, despite having added something like 1.8 million more people. So Melburnians have done a brilliant job in using water more efficiently.
And so have you, John, for making us do it. So thank you.
Right.
That's great. Now let's get to the great stink of London, because this we wouldn't even be talking about dual flush potentially if it wasn't for this momentous event in the history of that city.
Well, in those days, there was no sewage system, so human waste was put into the gutters, the drains, which overflowed and overflowed into the River Thames.
This is the 1850s?
1850s, no sewage. All the raw waste basically ended up in the Thames. And there was a period of low flow in the river, low tide, and a dry, hot day. And the whole river went septic and stank. Stank so badly that the parliaments in the Houses of Parliament, the Palace of Westminster,
yep,
had to evacuate the parliament. And if you want to get the attention of politicians, I think that is a brilliantly effective way to do it.
Because back in these days of pre-medical forefront, wasn't it also true that when those smells hit the nostrils, there was some thought that, in fact, smell was infectious?
They did. Swamp fever and things of that sort. During that period in the mid-1850s, Pasteur developed the theories of microbiology, and another gentleman in London called John Snow was the father of epidemiology. He traced human illness to contaminated water wells. But it took 40 to 50 years for that science to infiltrate the political consciousness to the point where the politicians had believed the scientists. And by the late, and there's a parallel in climate change there, by the late 19th century, they realised they had to do something. There was a big political will.
Yep.
And in Australia, in 1890, there were royal commissions, both in Sydney and Melbourne.
Into sanitation.
Called Royal Sanitary Commissions. That's what they are actually called. So a royal commission into that. The one in Melbourne resulted in the establishment of the Melbourne and Metropolitan Board of Works,
right,
based on a model that was then in place in London. and the microbiological diagnostic unit at Melbourne University, and they set about protecting Melbourne's catchments and sewering the city. In this, they brought out a Scottish engineer, Charles Mansur, who a beautiful job for an engineer, a blank sheet of paper.
And large amounts of money because of the gold rush, putting gold money rush, into government coffers.
Yep, coffers, and the Board of Works was provided with a property rate, power to raise a property rate so they could raise significant sums of money. And
because Melbourne used to be known as Smelbourne.
Yes, well, it was known as Smelbourne. Melbourne, the Yarra in those days, was an open sewer. It's not certainly not now.
No.
And Smelbourne, and Mansour developed this strategy of a sewage farm at Werribee. Another one was going to be at Carrum, but that's now a treatment plant. Major sewers under Melbourne, the North Yarra Main that goes under Flinders Street Station, and tunnel under the Yarra, Spotswood Pumping Station, which is now Science Works, beautiful building.
And so, John, I take it this technology that was at the very forefront of sanitation back in those days is the kind of the model that was adopted in other cities around Australia, was it?
Well, to a degree? It was a parallel development. I wouldn't say Melbourne led the way because Sydney and the other Australian cities, because we were governed from London,
yes,
and they were very influential about what we did in Australia. So it wouldn't say Melbourne led the way, but certainly they sewered Melbourne in the space of 15 years, the then Melbourne. My family had a house in Burke Road, near Burke Road, Glen Iris, in 1918, and they had a flush toilet,
In 1918?
1918, and that was the boundary of sort of metropolitan Melbourne in those days. So they...
Because the outhouse, of course, of Australian fame, excuse me, is still rampant in some parts of country Australia. You still have to go outside to go to the toilet.
Well, it surprisingly enough, in the 60s, both in Sydney and in Melbourne and other Australian cities, they were still using pans, sanitary pans. I had an aunt in Tarramurra, North Shore, who had a pan in the 1960s. I had other cousins in Burwood, East Burwood in Melbourne, who had a pan.
Yeah.
Because...
And there was a night soil man who would come down the back alleys to collect the soil from the family.
In those days, they didn't have the back alley, so we had to come in the front gate. But, because the First World War, the Depression, the Second World War, and a huge population boom in the 50s meant they couldn't keep up.
So, John, it's fair to say, isn't it, that if it hadn't been for the great stink of the 1850s in London, we probably wouldn't have seen these kind of technologies being adapted around the world. Because I want to introduce my second guest here today, and that is Paul Nichols, who's the Chief Executive of WaterAid Australia. As we look towards tomorrow, Paul, and World Toilet Day, we may laugh at some of the perceptions of disease and the impact of defecation that was there in Victorian England, back in the great stink of London. But in fact, what's really sad is that the attitudes towards the disease spread from lack of toilets and proper sanitation still is one of the great scourges of the world.
It absolutely is. That's right. So one in three people in the world, 2.3 billion people, still don't have access to a clean, safe toilet to use every day.
And some of that is cultural difficulties in coming to grips with disease and, I take it, appropriate behaviours.
In fact, all the parallels are exact between the history that we've experienced in our culture, in our civilization, the way we live, and the journey that developing countries are going through, on the path through. So, you know, literacy, education, economic development are all kind of really important features of that journey, as is political will, which is really the critical thing. So most of the countries we work in, the resources are there if there was the political will to ensure that there's clean, safe water and that there's hygiene, education and services for people to build their own toilets.
So yet again, the argument comes down to political will. If only we can move, as we've just talked about with John, in both Australia and England, then perhaps things could happen very quickly. In fact, you talk about some countries, I believe, that have made some big changes very quickly.
That's right. Well, just to demonstrate that it's not about having the financial resources, some of the poorest countries in the world, Nepal and Cambodia, for example, have been able to achieve masses of increases in people's access to good sanitation, whereas other countries that actually have more resources than those, places like Papua New Guinea, for example, East Timor, still lag way, way behind. Countries like Taiwan, South Korea, in the space of one generation, so even more quickly than Australia, within the space of 30, 40 years, gone from very low access to absolutely universal access.
And Paul, if we were to draw some kind of correlation between proper toilets and sanitation and disease profiles of those countries, what can you see?
Then you can see the very same things. So we know that there are still 900 children dying every single day from diarrheal disease in developing countries. And there's a direct link between people's access to clean, safe water in particular, but also the hygiene practices. And for hygiene practices, that's all about sanitation and removal of waste.
Right.
So still today, things that I've travelled, fortunately, this year to PNG, Cambodia and Timor, and to go and visit primary schools, local schools, discover that there are still schools being built without toilet facilities.
Even now?
Right now. And that's partly to do with education departments being responsible for schools, but the community or public works department being responsible for sanitation or water supply. And those things don't join up in planning of public services. And, of course, if there are no toilets at schools, girls in particular are the ones that miss out, because as soon as they reach puberty, they're not willing to attend and the parents are not willing to send them once they start menstruating. So it's kind of very confronting when you go and visit places, think, this shouldn't be happening today. But it's about creating the social norms that make it the standard practice. Why would you build a school without toilets?
I know.
How is that thinkable?
And the way you've just described the ripple effect that goes from simple disease containment and sanitation and hygiene through to cultural practices, gender segregation, that comes from simply not building pipes and toilets into a new dwelling.
That's right. And I think some of the lessons that John was talking about in Australia, the link between what is the science or what's the information? We all have information. How does that lead to behaviour change is a really challenging thing and something that WaterAid is working on quite a lot around the world. So partly it's about creating the political will for changes to take place, allocate resources, put in the right policies, but it's also about working with individuals and communities at the household level for them to work together and mobilise around what do we need to do in our community to make a better life. And that is, we all need to practice safe sanitation, good sanitation collectively, so that our children don't get sick. It's no good if one household does it. It's got to be a joint thing.
And I think it's also fair to say that as much as we congratulate ourselves for having the kind of systems that John Longford here has actually promoted in his time as an engineer around most parts of, well, national Australia, you only have to go into remote and rural areas of this country to see indigenous communities which are beset with some of the very same problems you've described in some of the countries globally that are still playing catch-up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the behaviour change thing is an everyday thing. I'm a parent, and I'm sure many, many listening are parents, and just reminding ourselves about what does it take to practice good hygiene behaviour? It takes a reminder every single mealtime to your kids.
Yeah.
Have you washed your hands? Have you washed your hands? Have you been outside? Have you been playing? It's what we learn at preschool, what we learn at primary school, what we learn every day in the home.
Paul. I've still doing it to my teenagers.
And I'm shocked to still tell you that if you do an analysis of the mobile phones of university students studying medicine, 30% of them will have fecal matter on them.
Oh!
So it's not a nice fact, but actually that hygiene practice is something that's, a deeply personal thing, and it really requires a lot of day-to-day attention.
Yes.
So if you're working in communities which they're resource poor. Families, parents, have got to make choices between what are they going to spend meagre resources they have. Are they going to spend money on the concrete block to build a latrine, or are they going to spend money on something else? Seeds to grow food.
Yeah.
Food for the day, sending their kids to school. I think what's amazing, WaterAid's experience is, though, when you work with communities on that link between hygiene, what it means for health, what it means for all these other opportunities, then communities do prioritise it. They do focus on those resources, and they advocate with their local government to say, we want the water supply and the toilets in the schools and in the health centres, because if we don't have it there, kids keep dying and it costs us money to have poor health.
Paul, John was describing the benefits that flow into Melbourne, and I don't mean to make a pun on that, but flowed into Melbourne from having all that gold rush in revenue in their coffers, so they could actually build a sort of cutting-edge technology sanitation system from scratch, which is still, in part, doing its job very well today. When you're talking about developing countries where there may be no infrastructure at all, aside from maybe roads and some electricity, how do you retrofit underneath or through communities that have been poverty-stricken for so long and had such established communities for so long?
There are some really exciting developments. So new technology gives us lots of different options and opportunities to address these sorts of issues. So particularly on the sanitation and the toilet front in rural communities. So instead of thinking about putting in massive expensive infrastructure, it's about what households can do for themselves. And even at a country level, when you're thinking about the resource boom that we experienced in the gold rushes, developing countries do have resources and resource booms. There's, you know, gas pipelines in Timor, there's mineral deposits in Papua New Guinea. It's a matter of making choices. And when you think about, even in the developing world today, there are more mobile phones than toilets. So that means people are making choices about where to spend their funds.
And I'm now thinking about all companies. The fecal matter on those mobile phones in all those developing countries because of you. But yeah. it's a valid point.
But it's also about companies and workplaces and political leadership saying, actually, what's important to our future development? And sometimes the really basic fundamental things are just overlooked.
Yep.
And part of our job is to make it a priority and give people technical solutions that make it possible. So, I mean, a lot of people travel right through Asia and would know that going to the toilet is a different experience in a lot of Asian countries when traveling, and especially if you tend to get sick along the way. But for very, very low cost, you can have improved pit latrines, you can have concrete slabs that people can put in themselves, and that makes an enormous difference to a family's health.
Well, given that a lot of developing countries tend to be centred around the equator where you have often high humidity and high temperatures, of course, that means decomposition happens very rapidly. Does that mean that kind of technology we see in dry parts of remote Australia, like composting toilets, don't work in those areas?
No, they absolutely do.
So they do?
Yep, you don't need to use lots of water and have flushing toilets. Dry composting toilets in those environments, when it's well designed, work really well. And you can create energy and electricity from the biogas. You can create compost for agriculture and livelihoods. There's all sorts of things that you can do to make it really effective.
John, can I just ask you, as someone who's been a long-time engineer in this realm, listening to what Paul has to say about some of the challenges we still face in 2015 to bring proper sanitation and toilets to a major proportion of the globe's population, any thoughts from your end on that?
Paul talked about new technology.
Yeah. But
you think of how you're going to manage human waste in a voyage to Mars. Humans that are on a spaceship need sanitation, and they've developed systems that will allow recycling, low energy, very efficient. One of these days, I think that technology is going to start infiltrating into the major cities and the sewage system, probably driven by the cost of us renewing the existing system. Can you imagine having to dig up suburban Melbourne and replace, going through barbecues, garages, God knows what, digging up, getting new pipes? There are ways of avoiding this, but I think when you have to renew something, it's a time to think again about what you're renewing. And so I think there's...
So simple off-grid household systems can be really effective and can work. One of the really exciting things we're trying in Cambodia in flood-prone areas, so we're thinking about climate change, changing environments, are floating toilets that sit off the back of people who live on barges or who live on floodplains.
Yes.
And enabling green composting systems to actually filtrate and turn the water into clean water back into the river systems and to use the material that's left over as waste. So there's some really interesting technologies that can help us. But again, I come back to, that's all really exciting, but there's some really basic things that we can all do at a very low cost if we could just mobilise the right political leadership to make that happen.
So what can we do to help what is essentially still a global issue?
Well, if people want to join us and help WaterAid do what we do, you can look at just search for WaterAid in your search engine and we'll come up and we'd love to have you support the work we do. But the other thing we can do is to encourage our Australian government to invest more of its aid money towards water and sanitation. We understand that there are resource constraints and the budget's being cut, but in the water and sanitation space, it's gone from less than 5% to less than 1% towards water and sanitation in our overseas aid program. But we know that the economic returns are enormous. So for every dollar we spend, there's $4 returned to that local economy from that investment. It's
and, on a lighter note, you're encouraging people to share toilet jokes.
Share toilet jokes. So we've had a campaign called It's No Joke to recognise it's no joke that this is happening. So let's make a bit of fun of it. Let's do some humour. And we've had some community events and campaigns, and there's ways people can donate to us through the It's No Joke website as well.
Okay. Well, look, I think we've covered World Toilet Day for tomorrow pretty comprehensively. John Longford, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming in. Mm-hmm. And also Paul Nichols, the WaterAid Australia Chief Executive. And we'll put links and details
thanks
up on
much.
Our page
Always
today.
Great to talk about toilets.
Yes, I love it too. I mean, it's an essential part of my day. I look forward to it. We didn't talk about the gender differences as to why men always bring literature to toilets and women don't. But that's for another time. In the meantime, if you'd like to share your toilet stories, I do urge you, they can be serious, they can be lighthearted. On Facebook, was it a luxurious five-star hotel where you had a memorable time, or was it perhaps a hole in the ground somewhere in India? You can tell us both on Facebook and also via text 0418 226 576. It's RN Afternoons. This is our CD feature.